Okay, gang, let's go ahead and get to it. Welcome to part two of Philosophy of Food. How are y'all doing? How many of you are graduating? Wow. It's a difficult time. It's a very distracting time, isn't it? Yeah, I know. It's almost like it shouldn't happen this way. It makes it really hard to teach upper division spring courses, right? And I'm pretty sure by the end of April this course will not, as powerful as the impact will have been on your life, it will not be as at the top of your minds. You'll be thinking about, you know, finishing up, all these wonderful people you know that you need to say goodbye or make arrangements to see in the future. It's a difficult time emotionally. But it's also really, you know, we have 6 weeks to really add. I'm really excited about what we're going to add to what we did the first half of the class. I hope the workload is moderate. I hope it's reasonably interesting. And I want to try to encourage you in the last 6 weeks to really take on a couple of questions, short-term research, really, if you will. As I study food, I just always encounter things that don't fit, that don't make sense. One author says one thing, another author says another thing. And we'll, now that we're getting into nutrition, we're going to see that even more. And I'm going to try and entice you into figuring out some things, whether on the sciencey side of what we have to read or on the less sciencey side, that kind of take you into the topic. And so I know that there's a lot of things competing for your attention in the next 6 weeks, and I will try to make this course fairly streamlined, especially towards the end of the semester. But I'd also like to kind of encourage you, and I'll try to do that in some real practical ways today as well, to really take on a couple of questions that you're motivated to answer. They could be personal questions about your own food diet. They could be questions about conflicts between different things we're going to read in different sources, things that are just on your mind. And so that would be, we'll see if I can encourage you to do that. We have a couple of food news things. I have a couple of food news things for you. Maybe some of you guys have some food news. Maybe it's going to take us a class or two to get back into food news. I don't know. I always like hearing what you guys have. Any food news on top of your heads? Anybody ready for it with the food news? Over the break, you didn't encounter any interesting food? Yes, sir.
I found an article this morning, actually, talking about artificial meat, but based on actual animal proteins.
Oh,
so
like lab meat, sometimes people call it.
Yeah. So using
good
stem cells from like cows and sort of coaxing it into beef.
Yeah, there's lab meat. And then there's also the heme burger. Remember the heme burger? That's going to come up back into the class today, because that is a plant-based heme that he's using in that. It's called the Impossible Burger or something goofy. But yeah, we haven't really talked about lab meat. There are. What did you find? It's an expensive burger. It's like that. We don't have a production burger yet for this, do we?
Yeah. The first one they ever made in 2013 cost $330,000.
It's an expensive burger. They're going to get the price.
Apparently, it's down to $11.
It's down to $11, really?
This, yeah.
Is it a burger, or is it... Because some of the lab meat is more like the consistency of white meat.
It says they've reportedly gotten the price of the burger down to $11.
Wow. Yeah, I think the heme burger... So that's not the heme burger? It's not called the Impossible Burger? Okay.
No.
Yeah, these are two different techniques. Remember, this heme guy, he figured out how to take plant heme and synthesize it in high levels. But if anybody wants to look into lab meat, that's a really good one. Would you guys eat lab meat, I think? You would?
I might try it.
Right. Anything else? Food news? Thanks. That's good food news. Anything else? Maybe some of you will have an item that will occur to you. My food news is kind of straightforward, maybe. Maybe this will interest some of you. I ran across a really interesting site that I'm trying to encourage all my meat-eating friends to try out and tell me about, because this is a site that allows you to buy shares of an animal. Oh, look, that animal was only 5% sold last hour. It allows you to buy shares in an animal that's grass-fed and grass-finished. And I think the assumption, if you're interested in this, you should drill down on it. The assumption is that you're going to get a pretty freshly butchered animal. And there is a lot of, there is research on aging beef makes it taste better, but also getting beef fresh makes it taste better. I think both are, yes?
Grass-finished just mean it's
A lot of times grass-fed beef can be finished on corn in like a feedlot. So so finishing refers to the last few pounds they add to it before it's slaughtered. And so you want to, they're distinguishing their product from people who do grass-fed but then send it off to someone to be fattened up to get the last few bucks out of it. And so this is going to be expensive meat. I don't know how you guys, there's different packages they offer, but... it may be kind of pricey for a student budget. I don't know. Maybe you can tell you. I know, yeah. If you're going to go to a steakhouse, you're going to have this. Yeah.
Isn't grass-fed beef naturally less fatty? And I always...
has a higher proportion of omega-3 fats than omega-6 fats.
I just don't know if, like, people are more adapted to the taste of fatty, like, steaks, and if they prefer that taste.
No, that's a big issue. We got back in the lipid phobia days, we got people off fat meat. Cattle ranchers started feeding their cattle more corn, which is cheaper. And it partly we moved away from this marbled beef. And so you might find it might be like milk. Some of you have reported trying whole milk after being raised on skim milk, and it's like, oh my God, this is too much. So it might be like that. It might mean that you don't need as much, too. It might be like they have a 32-ounce steak that they recommend feeding 2 to 4 people, and I'm like, wow, that's a lot of meat. 32 ounces, I would have thought that could feed like 6 or 7 people, but you know, there's this issue about the plate. You know, is the standard plate on an American diet mostly meat and then a little bit of vegetable, or do you put a little bit of meat in a lot of it? Yeah, good. Other thoughts on this? Yeah, if any of you want to go in on buying part of an animal here and tell me what it tastes like, you can have like a dinner party. It looks pretty yummy. I mean, I don't eat meat, but it looks pretty tasty. Hey, that's one of my mind. And it's local, too. Well, it's on the west side, Curtis, I guess. Last semester, I was put in a proposal to a philosophy of food conference. I don't know how interesting this would be for you guys to look at, but you can always check. If you're curious about what a philosopher might do at a philosophy of food conference. This is, Evan, you'll recognize this from the seminar. This was kind of something I was working on back in the philosophy seminar. So maybe that's interesting. Gets me to Los Angeles in June. And the third thing I had for you today is that my favorite librarian, Linda Pierce, put together a research page for us on philosophy of food, and it has some pretty cool stuff. I've watched Slow Food Revolution. We're going to be talking about the slow food movement a little bit later in April, and this site just kind of highlights some stuff that Foley has related to food. So if you're curious or you want to browse something new, you might find something interesting there. Okay. Feel free to interrupt with anything you got. That's about all I had. Any other food news? Yes, come
on. Yeah, so... a lot of people probably know, but during Lent, Catholics are not supposed to be eating meat on Fridays, as per tradition. And I'm from the West Side, and I was over there for break, and apparently the Archbishop for Seattle sent out to all the parishes letters allowing for the parishioners to eat meat this last Friday.
How interesting.
During St. Patrick's Day.
What was the motivation for that? How interesting.
He's Irish.
Oh,
so we'll buy it, but still.
Okay. So being
that.
Irish, he knows he
acceptance.
Wants meat on his holiday. Is that the idea?
I mean, it's traditional for the holiday. Like
yeah.
People have corned beef, which is what.
Right.
Like,
because
my parish at home always does a whole celebration of corned beef.
Oh, cool.
Meal, and I know for our parish it got canceled this year, which is pretty sad.
It's a nice footnote on our study of religion and diet, right? Because this is a case where, there's a little pressure. One's trumping the other.
Right.
Like, it's an ethnic food holiday. I want my ethnic food. It's got to be beef. But we do have a tradition of being meatless on many days in the Catholic calendar. I didn't know that was still the thing. So so Catholics still go meatless on just on Friday in Lent. When I was growing up, it was every Friday was meatless. It was just like part of the deal. You know? And Vatican II wasn't going to change that. My parents were pretty solid about that. Yeah, good. That's good food detail. Thanks. Anything else? Yes.
I just find this really interesting because I was thinking I haven't seen it anywhere yet.
Sure.
But Starbucks just came out with a new organic avocado spread.
Oh, okay. I was thinking about their egg thing. They made an egg thing recently. This is an avocado spread. What's
yeah, so, I mean, I don't know too much about it because
that
it
reminds
just
me.
Came out today.
Is that right? I have, oh, darn it, I didn't bring the right one. I've been collecting these breakfast cards because my Starbucks person gives them to me. But I don't eat their food, so I'll bring some next time, and I'm gonna make a deal with anybody who wants a free Starbucks item that they have to report back on it, like do some research on its nutritional quality, and tell us how it tasted. You know, I'll be quite honest with you. I think Starbucks is basically serving airplane food. You know, and if you look at it, the way it's packaged under the counter, the way it comes in, it's all frozen. It's what you get on an airplane. That doesn't mean you shouldn't eat it. It's your business, but I just turned off to it. And you know, in the history of Starbucks, it's good for business students who are also philosophers. You know, Starbucks made a choice at one point in its corporate development to not do locally sourced food with coffee. And it was a smart business choice because you don't make much money if you're buying other people's products and reselling them. So if you vertically integrate all the food, right, and you're selling it all out of, you know, freezers and big trucks, lo and behold, you can avoid jacking up the price of the coffee, maybe. So I think I get cheaper prices on my coffee because other people are eating the food. I don't know. But anyway, something to think about. I'll bring my... I have two or three of these that are all filled in, so I'll bring it. Yeah, so did you learn anything about the avocado spread in particular? Is it pretty yummy?
No.
Are people talking about it?
I would like to try it.
Yeah, yeah. No, we're going to talk about engineered food tomorrow.
So far, like, all the articles have really good reviews.
Cool.
But...
Good. Yeah, neat. Okay, anything else? Yeah, please. We have time.
Starbucks also added a gluten-free breakfast sandwich.
Ah, that's good to know.
Which is kind of cool because, like, a lot of places, like, especially, like, more national places don't have, like, ready-made gluten-free.
Ah, that's interesting. Good.
Is
it the what? And it's the bread. It's just the bread that's gluten free, and
yeah, I mean the whole thing is gluten free, but
the ingredients. Good. Yeah. Good. That's good to know. Yeah. Please.
It's
come
also
on.
Also, kind of like a Starbucks. I'm not going to talk about this in here.
Sure.
But when they first came out with a breakfast sandwich, Howard Schultz was really against them because he thought the smell of the cheese,
right,
I guess, a very sharp nose,
right,
was, like, detractable from black coffee. Like, because he wanted the smell of coffee in there instead.
Yeah.
So they like engineered a whole new oven/microwave.
Ah, I didn't know that. That's
now
interesting.
Now you smell more coffee instead.
Ah, so the those fancy ovens they use probably take the smell away.
Yeah, somehow.
That's neat. That's good to know. That's great. Yeah. You're reminding me that Starbucks is opening their first business in Italy now. I think do you know what city it is?
I heard about that.
Yeah. They'd stayed out of Italy for a long time. Yeah. What? They had, you know, it would be good to research. I thought they had done it as a conscious choice not to disrupt that coffee culture, because Italian coffee culture is pretty different than Starbucks coffee culture. But I think now it's like, well, what the hell? They drink a lot of coffee. Let's go get some, you know. So yeah, that's a good example of little things that where I like your thing and others. Where if you get a curiosity, it may just be something you look up in 20 minutes along with reading for the class, and then you've got something interesting to share with us. Or it could be something that requires a little bit of research. It's something you're curious about. I have a couple of topics like that that'll come up in our work today. And so I'm going to... So, yeah, good. Excellent. Yeah. Good food news. Thanks. All right. Let's... housekeeping thing. The pantry fuel class was scheduled for the same time, or a little bit after the basketball game this Thursday, so that didn't work. So what we have is two dates and two times that for next week, Wednesday and Thursday, 4 to 6, 6 to 8. So if you're, I think it's going to be a really good class I'd like to go to, and if you're interested in going to the class, then fill out the form. So you can do that now if you want, or you can do it by tonight. I'd like to get back to Jenny by tomorrow morning and see what how what we've got. Yeah.
I already bought the class for this Thursday, but I can't go next week.
She told me especially to look out for people who had already signed up for the class. Oh, yikes. Next week doesn't work.
Is there going to be a later...
I hope so. I would like us. She wants to do two, and so we could. Even if this one doesn't make because of the rescheduling, we could that you know we could still try to offer the other one.
Okay.
Yeah, but we'll definitely take care of you. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That's too bad. She said especially look out for the people who had all. I think four or five people had already signed up. So yeah, if you're in that category and the times don't work out, we'll try to make it right. Okay. Good. Anything else? Yeah. So please fill that out soon, like be today. Okay. All right. Okay, the other maintenance thing had to do with this worksheet that the protein chapter. I'm afraid I caused some confusion as usual because I didn't say anything about turning it in. And so I meant to just put it on the table as a suggestion, and so let's talk about it real quick now. Did a bunch of you fill it out? Good. Yes, great. We'll make use of it today. My suggestion would be to move, I think there's kind of, probably most of you would be happy for us to move away from quizzes a bit. And really the nutrition chapters, I don't see what, it would be weird to quiz you on it. There's a lot of information in there. And I'd like us to focus on what's useful for us as philosophers of food. So so my suggestion would be that I put out five questions on a work that would be like a worksheet for each chapter. So for next, we're going to be doing these nutrition chapters kind of on our Tuesdays for a little while, I think. And so I would get that out to you by Thursday, and then you'd turn them in. And then I would send a Google form out and say, give me your answers to questions 2 and 4, say. You know, I would sample your questions, your answers. And then you'd get credit for that. It'd be like a point credit thing. And I wouldn't grade them so much, you know, as long as they made sense. So does that sound like a reasonable approach for the nutrition chapters? So they would definitely be off the quiz agenda. Now, whether we can stay away from quizzes in general, it really kind of depends on whether you guys feel like you can get the reading done without that as a motivation. And I'm trying to be very realistic that other things are demanding your attention and that other assignments maybe need to be done first. That's one of the reasons for doing quizzes, is that it creates an assignment that you need to respond to. On the other hand, you know, I think we're doing pretty well on reading level. I think, you know, a lot of times you guys have details to bring in when I ask you, you know, to chime in with details from your reading. So I'm kind of going to look for that over the next few classes and see if we're getting a high enough general level of reading so that the folks in the class who didn't get to the reading on a particular day don't have to be in fear of a quiz, but we can still kind of carry them along and have a really rich discussion, which is really hard to do if nobody's read. So let's see if we can do it that way. If we need to bring back a quiz or two, I'll try and do it by announcement. I'll try and say, hey, I think we ought to have a quiz this Thursday, and then you'll know ahead of time. So I think we can get rid of surprise quizzes. Okay. All right, yeah.
So have you created a Google document?
I'll do a little form for soliciting
okay.
that. For this one, is it okay if we just treat it as a practice? Is that, I mean, if you want 5 points, I'll give you 5.
So where are we turning in we'll do the Google form like at the beginning of class, or are you going to, when you send out the questions?
I'll send out the questions with a form link, and then it'll be like, do the questions. Well, I'm going to be sampling, so yeah. I'll send out the questions, and then before class, you'll get a form link, and I'll ask you to send in some answers. So the deadline will be before class on the day that we talk about that chapter. Good, thanks. Others? Good. Okay, let's get to our work. We've got a lot of interesting stuff to talk about. Oh, sorry, before we get to our reading today, this will be real quick. I just want to kind of, you know, remind you that this is philosophy of food, and remind you of some of the things we talked about in the first half, and then kind of what's going to be a little different in the second half, what's going to be the same. So, you know, just remember with me, in the first half of the class, we did some work on philosophical analysis of food culture. I associate that mostly with Montanari. Critiques of the U.S. food system, which we got from our documentaries, we got from Nestle, we got from Pollan. Models for healthy eating, which we got from looking at dietary guidelines, also from Pollan. Anthropology and history of human experience with soil and agriculture. I'm going to ask you at the end of the semester if we did too much of that. I kind of binged on, I was very excited about that. So I had a lot of readings about, you know, the history of agriculture, the history of human civilization's interaction with soil. But, you know, I was glad we did it. I'll let you tell me at the end of the term whether you think it's going to be shorter. We had a little bit on the restaurant. We did some food culture there. We did a little overview of food ethics in the second half of the course. Food ethics is going to be a lot more prominent. We did some things on religion and food. We talked about food culture in colonial U.S., in 19th century food culture in the U.S., with the spas and the cereal industry. And those contemporary groups like the Transcendentalists and the Shakers who had food-based, food-related religion. And then the practical work in the first half was the diet review exercise, which many of you did, and some analytic writing, which we did right before before break, which you got back and can see. By the way, I want to thank you particularly. A lot of you did the diet review exercise, which, as you know, is good for 5% of your... grade. You can do other installments whether you did the first one or not. The one that's coming up that several of you have indicated that you're going to do is to make a change in your diet. So that could be the elimination of something or the reduction of something. It could be the addition of something. It could be a focus on nutrition, but it could be also a focus on, some of you in your journals said, what I'd really like to do is find a new dish that I really love. That's a great objective for the second step. Some of you are discovering or rediscovering ethnic foods from your family history. So there's a wide variety of things you can do in this, you know, sort of next step, if you will, of diet alteration. And the idea would be to make a change, do the research related to the change if there's research to be done, experience the change, and write about it in the journal, right? So something I'm doing that I started yesterday was, I mentioned to you, is that I want to do a study of my protein intake. And I'll get into this a little bit when we do our protein calculations from the chapter. But I have a little concern as an older person and someone who's not eating meat that maybe my protein levels or maybe could be higher. So I'm just pounding this protein powder that I got. It's really something. So I just like, this is just the second or third day. So I'm going to do that for a month. And I'm going to try to notice, I'm going to combine it with some, you know, my usual workouts and things, and I'm going to try and notice how I feel. So that's kind of a food experiment in your diet. And so I want to invite you to consider, whether you did the first one or not, consider doing something in your diet that reflects a question you have about your diet. It could be related to satisfaction, practicality, or nutrition.
Is it just 100% whey?
Yeah, I chose it. Now, there are vegan protein powders. I've had tried one of those. I found them kind of hard to swallow, and I wasn't sure about the protein levels, so I chose a protein whey isolate. Yeah, and I learned recently that the protein whey was actually a byproduct of cheese making that got thrown out in the past, and then once these protein powders became popular, we started finding a way to use. So that was protein we were throwing out. So yeah.
I just wanted to clarify.
Sure.
You said it was 5% of the grade. Is that for each section or is that?
Each section. So yeah, you could actually get up to 25. I don't know if there's going to be time for anybody to do all four. I think I was a little ambitious with that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, 5% for each effort, basically.
Okay.
So yeah, it could be 10 or 15%.
I have a close friend who's starting a new diet. Like they just started a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be an option to, like, kind of interview them?
Ah, that's interesting.
Like, instead
track
of
them.
At your own diet?
Yeah, you could. Absolutely. If you're interested, what kind of diet are they doing? Easy to describe?
Yeah. It's like, so they're only eating between, like, 2 and 10 p.m.
Oh, interesting.
Each day and eating, like, a lot in those hours.
Yeah.
Intermittent fasting.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, yeah, I'm fasting for, like, 16 hours.
Oh, it's a fasting diet. Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, fast for
good.
16 hours and then eat a lot during those hours.
Those are cool experiments. Yeah, yeah, that's great. Yeah, so you could talk to him or her about how that's going. Yeah.
Okay.
That's a good example of the kind of, you know, so we're calling it the elimination diet stage, but it really could involve things like that, like
okay.
Scheduling of eating. Yeah.
Oh,
sorry.
No, sorry.
Yeah.
Who's the Old Spice guy?
The Old Spice guy.
Terry Crews.
He's doing the same thing.
Yeah. Is that right?
It's not the Old Spice guy, though. It's Terry Crews.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is he not the Old Spice
guy? No,
he's not.
He used to be the Old Spice guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things about experimenting with fasting that I've noticed is that some people use it as a way of exploring control of hunger, and so if you do this, one thing that you may have a baseline, a set of assumptions about how often you need to eat and how much, but those are pretty habit related. So years ago I did this where I tried to imitate this person's diet where they didn't eat until noon, and then they only ate basically two meals a day, and it was interesting because it taught me that my feeling of hunger is not a natural fact that's unalterable. My feeling of hunger is partly related to a habit I have of when I eat. And so many of you noticed that. I'm getting some nods. So you could also just any behavioral thing about your diet that you want to just experiment with or watch someone else experiment with.
Yeah,
that's great. That's a little easier.
Yeah,
it's
really interesting, so I was
wonder
if I could just
absolutely
interview that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is that something that's supposed to be like long-term, or do you do it like a week? I think he's doing it. I just trying to do it for a while.
Yeah.
I did it for 6 months.
Oh, wow.
What's like the purpose?
Yeah.
Like,
is there a theory?
I was doing it to lose weight at the time, and I mean, I was in good shape already. I was playing tennis for school in Southern California, and I was just like playing around with it because I was working out a lot. And I had a super high protein diet, low fat, and low carbs. So I would wake up and I wouldn't eat until like 11, and then I would stop eating around 6 p.m. And so that's like an average time for people when they're intermittent fasting.
Right.
And so when you go to bed, you're just super hungry. But every time you wake up in the morning, it feels like you've lost, like, 5 pounds.
And breakfast is incredibly appealing.
Yeah.
Like, one of the things that fasting diets are about is increasing your desire for food when it's time to eat. So if you're trying, so some of you indicate in your journals you might want to move to a lower meat diet, but meat's really satisfying. So one technique that people use is to use fasting to get used to a new food item that they may not initially have a craving for, and then you develop a habit for it. So, you know, so being hungry is a great relish, is the old adage. You know?
To answer your question, it is pretty sustainable. Like, because you feel good when you're doing it. If you drink a lot of water, like, right before you go to bed, you don't have, like, those intense hunger pains, but you will have them, like, crazy when you first start it. But then you kind of, like, look for those hunger pains because then you know you're, like, doing it right. And
does it go away? Does that hunger pain thing go away?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and then you can increase your window or decrease your window of the time you eat and, like, the amount of time you're fasting. But, like, it's not recommended to go, like, lower than that.
Do you eat the same amount of food, but just, like, in that period? Like, if you eat, like, 1,000 calories a day or whatever, do you just eat those 1,000 calories in that time?
Yeah, so I was still eating 5 meals instead of, like, from, you know, 9 a.m. to, like, 9 p.m., I was eating them in from 11 to 6.
You're basically, like, constantly eating. There's some, like, science. It's like,
I know, that's right. Does that work?
What do you have a job?
Like, so a lot of it, I think,
it's really hard,
like, people who are
job.
Trying to build a lot of muscle, like, that's a big factor.
Oh, do they? Is people are attracted like that? Are attracted?
I think, yeah. From the sound of it, what he was saying is, like,
did you have something on this?
So, like, from what I know about it,
sure.
You intermittent fast, like, it helps you put yourself in a caloric deficit.
Yeah.
So, the goal is not to, like, go to bed super hungry, but, like, it's easier if you're hungry and you wake up and then you don't eat till, like, 2 o'clock. It's easier to, like, not eat.
Right.
And once you start eating, it makes you more hungry.
Okay. Right.
So,
right. So for you, it's also partly about appetite control, or no?
Yeah, I mean, and I don't. I'm not trying to lose weight, but when I sometimes I cannot eat, or it just helps you not eat for longer.
Yeah.
So it just helps you put yourself in a caloric.
Absolutely. I mean, let's just be honest about it. Almost everybody reports some food items that they have trouble not eating too much of. I mean, it's just, it's okay. You know, we can just say it. And some of you in your journals report a lot of food items that you have trouble not eating too much of. So the idea of manipulating your sense of hunger really is an interesting technique. I will warn you that one theory about anorexia is that anorexics get too good at it. That anorexics get to the point where it's too easy not to eat. Like you I remember this account I read a few years ago where this woman was saying it flipped at some point from being hard not to eat to easy not to eat.
Yeah, Katie and I are both in a class and we just had a presentation about anorexia and this scientist did an experiment where he severely restricted his calories and exercised a lot, so he became anorexic, and he said for the first 3 months it was like very draining, no energy, but at that 3 month mark all of a sudden he had increased energy, he was able to like curb his hunger, he felt like he had a great body image and he felt like he was doing well. And there's something that switches in that where you're.
And did he ever? But was he unhealthy?
He had to force himself to stop because
Right.
He can see the psychological buildup of it. So
yeah.
Something about that.
Yeah, I mean it's pretty interesting. I mean, it's good for us to be acknowledging this because there are dangers on both sides of that continuum, right?
Like you're talking about, like those hunger pains. That is just what came into my mind.
Right.
It's like you don't want to curb those too much because then
absolutely
you're
no, that's
that
really yeah. In fact, that's a serious warning.
I guess I got lucky then.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
well, I don't know.
It was
always
a fight, like to continue it because I just eat a lot in general. So
right.
It's like I never really found that.
It's a very different pattern. You're not.
It
like
still sounds like you're eating a lot of food within
yeah.
that. Like,
right.
Brain.
So you could go the other way, too. You could have an experiment where you say, wow, I think what I'd like to do is, here are some points in the day when I make bad food decisions because I'm hungry and I don't have something to eat and it's between meals. And you could say, well, okay, I want to find an in-between meal that works for that time. So you could do other kinds of experiments that involve spreading out your eating as well. So, yeah, good. You guys are very active today. That's good. It's good to get back into this with you. Okay, well, we have plenty of more opportunities to talk about this. Let's go ahead and get into our work. So in the second half, we're basically going to drill down on nutrition. We're going to really do our gastronomy unit. And as you know from my emails, I reorganized that. So gastronomy is going to happen a little more on Thursdays, and then nutrition is going to happen a little more on Tuesdays. And then at the end of April, we're really going to dig into the food ethics stuff. And that'll be a really interesting discussion, I think. We've got a lot of reading to do on that. So, okay, let's go ahead and get to the chapter and then also the protein chapter. So with Gratzer, let's just get a few notes here. I think this is a pretty straightforward piece of work. Here are four things that I found significant in the chapter. I'm going to give you the themes first, and then we'll go into the details of the chapter. First, this chapter gives you an image of discovery, of nutrition science discovery. This is a turning point. The Harriet Chick's visit to Vienna was a turning point in our acceptance of remedies for scurvy and rickets. And so it's an image of food nutrition science, a moment of revelation, big moments. Second is, this is a really interesting story about science and gender. This is the early 20th century, and women are not represented well in science at all, and they're not respected very well in science. And this is about a woman, a very highly regarded scientist in World War I, who goes to this German scientific culture, which is all male, and really kind of makes the case. And so they overcome a kind of bias. And so I think it's a nice science gender story. The third thing is, it's a really good food justice issue to notice how diseases of nutrition, and remember we're talking about scurvy, beriberi, and rickets, it's a real food justice issue to remind ourselves that mostly the poor, and up to 40% of the poor in Great Britain, had rickets. And large percentages of other populations in Europe had nutrition-based diseases. So let's link that to what we already know about the Western diet and how and the diseases of the Western diet and who gets those, right? So in US culture, the Western diet doesn't produce scurvy, beriberi, and rickets. It produces what? What are the diseases of the Western diet?
Obesity.
Cardiovascular disease.
Diabetes,
yeah. Metabolic disorders. Right. You mentioned heart? No.
Cardiovascular,
yeah, right? Okay, and then a host of others. So those diseases fall, we're going to look at data on this later, but those diseases fall disproportionately among social classes that have to buy cheap calories, right? So that's one social food justice issue where we can connect today's chapter with today, right? Another one is that, and we're going to read this in our nutrition chapters, different ethnicities are affected by the Western diet to different degrees. Obesity rates for African American and Hispanic women are extraordinary. They're in the 70s and 80% range. Different bodies respond to the Western diet in different ways. Western Europeans, Northern Western Europeans are less affected by the Western diet. Why? The plausible hypothesis is that they've been eating it longer. They've been eating a high meat diet longer. But anyway, there's metabolism is different. So the food justice issue in this chapter connects the earliest 20th century diseases of nutrition as a food justice issue to the diseases of nutrition of the wealthy countries like the U.S. Fourth one is that this chapter kind of shows you why we're so fierce about milk subsidies. You know, milk subsidies have become kind of irrational. I don't know if we got too much of that in the first half of the course. But in the U.S., milk is still heavily subsidized. What does a gallon of milk cost today? $2.50, something like that? Yeah. So I think unsubsidized it would be twice that or maybe more. I don't know the number. But one of the reasons we're attached to milk subsidies is because of the history of nutrition. We know how serious a lack of vitamin D is in child development. And so we have this fierce connection to it. Okay, so let's go ahead and take a look at the story in the chapter and try not to make too much time out of it because the protein stuff is pretty interesting. All right, so I just want to tell you the narrative. You read this, but I just want to kind of remind you of it, ask you to bring in details that appealed to you, and then we'll see where we are. So most of the chapter is the story of Harriet Chick going with her colleague, Elise Dalyell, to Vienna. And she'd been to Vienna before. She was a very worldly, highly educated woman. But she was going to meet Viennese scientists like this guy, von Pirquet, right? And this is the main narrative. Ready for your notes? And this is the main thing you need to remember to kind of reignite your memory of the chapter. This is a story about a conflict between two scientists' theories about disease. Von Pirquet thinks the diseases he's looking at are the result of an infectious disease, or caused by an infection. Whereas Chick understands that ascorbic acid alleviates scurvy. And her hunch is that it's a nutritional-based disease. Now, I was looking this up. We didn't have this for the first class, but you guys can write this in your notes. We didn't actually isolate vitamin C. It turned out this Russian guy, I think. We didn't actually isolate vitamin C until 1933, I think this article says. 1930s. I thought it was Linus Pauling, but apparently it's this guy from Hungary. It's not a Russian guy, it's a Hungarian guy. And so in the story, in the chapter, we still didn't know it was vitamin C, but we did know there were these. We didn't know they were amines, you know, vitamins, or in this class of chemicals called amines. But we knew there were these chemicals that if you didn't, we knew there was something in some foods that if you didn't get it, you got these diseases. So the point for your notes would be, into the first, second, third of the 20th century, we were still guessing about what it was in food that kept people from getting certain horrible diseases. And Harriet knew what foods to use, and she had to prove that against a medical establishment that had a very different theory about what was causing these diseases. So that's the drama of the narrative. It's a pretty cool narrative. So what happens is she goes to Vienna, and she reports this, by the way. Remember in the chapter, she's still alive in the 70s, and she's getting some award on page 6. And she says everybody was kind of politely incredulous. They didn't believe her, you know. So there was a real drama to this. It really was a conflict. But there was this one guy who, you know, everybody else was just kind of like not paying attention to them. So there's this one guy, what's his name? Birkenbach or whatever his name is. Where is he? Birkenbach. So this one guy he had been in the East Indies as a Brit, and he had experienced beriberi or experienced it in other people. So he was more open to her hypothesis. All right, so here's the moment of truth, right? She goes into the infantile scurvy clinic, and she mixes up some ascorbic acid, some lemon juice, diluted because babies have trouble taking it. And within a few days, scurvy's going away. And these doctors, these eminent Viennese doctors, like von Pirquet, have to say, and he, to his credit, he does, I was wrong. And it's kind of hard for them to take this from a woman, too. I mean, to be quite honest with you, this is a time when people would have had trouble with that. So that's the first big moment. Make sure you got that in your note. Chick demonstrates that, now, to be quite precise, she doesn't demonstrate vitamin C because she doesn't know it's vitamin C. She demonstrates that ascorbic acid or lemon juice can cure the infants of scurvy. Then, almost the next day, she goes into a clinic where there's a patient that has ulceration of the cornea, which is, we know now, is a deficiency of vitamin D. And she gives the guy some cod liver oil, and within a few days, his sight improves. Okay, this is you also learn in this chapter that the absence of vitamin D among soldiers is a cause of night blindness. So your ability to see at night goes first, right? Because it's hard to discriminate things at night. So cod liver oil becomes the big star here, and I just wanted to kind of remind you, it's just remarkable how much vitamin D cod liver has. So this is a teaspoon of cod liver oil, and it's got 113% of your vitamin D needs for the day. When I was a kid, parents were still trying to get their kids to take a teaspoon of cod liver oil every day. I resolutely refused. It was disgusting. It smelled like fish. It was horrible. So then you learn in the article that, tuna livers have even more. And so this is an incredible discovery, an incredible source. Okay, so then the third dramatic moment, all right, we got the first one with infant scurvy, we got the second one with the guy with the ulcerated cornea. The third is a study, and this is really, I think, a very dramatic story that Gratzer's telling. So they invite Harriet back to Vienna and to now solve the problem of rickets in the city of Vienna. We were talking about high percentages of kids. And rickets is a bone deformation, so you get these bowl legs, you have thin bones that break easily. So they start a study, and the study involves, it's a clinical trial, and von Pirquet's diet is a diet based on, let's get this out, this is kind of interesting. Von Pirquet's diet is enriched supplements containing vitamin D, but this is the crucial point for your notes. It was based on milk from cattle that were kept in stalls and that had very little fat. So they had less fat-soluble vitamin D than Harriet's diet. So then there was a control group, and then Harriet's diet is full cream milk and cod liver oil. So you can see she's packing a vitamin D punch that's totally different than him, right? So they start the trial. Her kids get better. They stop the trial. So dramatic. Okay, this happens in science, it happens in nutrition science, where the clinical trial has to be stopped because the results are so dramatic that it seems unethical to keep feeding kids the bad diet. Right? So those are the three dramatic moments in that chapter, as far as I can tell. And I think they're pretty interesting. Can we draw out some of the things they tell us about nutrition science? Any reactions to those? I thought that was pretty fascinating. Yeah, any thoughts? Good. Okay, so minimally we can say for your notes that this is a moment in which we really have wrong. We've got these false ideas about nutrition, and the thing about. That's really kind of the moment. It's a moment of discovery and understanding in which we really are starting to appreciate that there's a class of chemicals, they still don't know what they are, that are crucial in relation to these diseases. Okay? So I gave you a couple of quick notes on these diseases in case I have trouble keeping them straight in my head, but scurvy is a vitamin C deficiency, beriberi is a vitamin B1 deficiency, and then rickets is mostly a vitamin D deficiency, but it includes, could be a phosphorus or calcium deficiency. A small detail on this, let's see, yeah, I think we have time for this. One of the ways, just to indicate how confusing nutrition science is one of the false theories about rickets was that people who have rickets need to get out into fresh air and get exercise. And the reason that made sense was because if you get out into sunshine, you get vitamin D production through your skin. But notice how that can be a false indicator, because it turns out it has nothing to do with the exercise, or it only has to do with the fresh air that's keeping the sun from coming in, because London at this time, and Vienna maybe too, would have been very polluted cities. So it's just, the point for your notes is it's really easy to go wrong in nutrition science because there's so much complexity to it. You could be doing the right thing, but you could be using milk from poorly fed cows, and so you get the wrong idea from that. Okay. All right, that's most of what I had from that. And then the last part of the chapter is kind of cool. This is about the extreme self-experiments. Do you remember this? Let's see if we can remember this together. So then you get industrial production of cod liver oil, and we're off to the races. So Robert McCants and L.C. Widdowson seem to be just colleagues, although they spend a lot of time together in this story. So they get together in 1933, and you already learn that L.C. had been working in a lab that separated amino acids for the first time. So put in your notes, it's 1933, and we just figured out what protein is. And we're going to talk about protein today, right? But this, part of my theme in studying nutrition history is to appreciate its complexity, but how late it happens. I mean, you know, the other thing for your notes about these guys is they're the people who produced the first compendium of what's in food. So this is the first time you've got nutrition scientists who have good enough chemistry skills, and the motivation to actually do this. It takes them 4 years, and they produce basically what, you know, the contemporary version of that is nutrition data self, which is, you know, a pretty sophisticated version of that, right? So that's the first database of chemical compositions of food. And again, it's 1940. The quest here, as we get into mid-century, the quest is to figure out what is the minimum diet? What is the minimum healthy diet? You notice you need that if you're at war, because you got soldiers you need to feed, and you learned in this chapter that a lot of wars are lost on malnourished soldiers. It's really quite stunning. It's really gruesome. But you've also got people back home who are trying to keep the economy going, and there's you've got that kind of pious stomach theme that we had in the part of that Wallach chapter we didn't read. And so you've got a quest for figuring out, like, what is a healthy diet? So you've got the curing of disease, but you've also got this effort to kind of say, well, you know, what is a healthy diet? And the U.S. Dietary guidelines are an example of that today. The last detail, did anybody find the self-experimentation interesting? Did you notice that maybe you didn't get all the way to the end here, but back on page 12, McCants and Widdowson engaged in these pretty gruesome self-experiments. So what he would do, he was trying to figure out how salt affected water retention. You know, now we know, right, that you need, now we have more sophisticated views of this, right, which include electrolytes and things, but we know now that salts are good to have in sports drinks, right, because they keep you from sweating. So he had to do this over-breathing exercise where you breathe in and out deeply as rapidly as possible for 45 minutes. And you can die doing this. You're turning your blood alkaline by doing that. And so he conks out. She finds him unconscious. And but he discovers the relationship between salt and water, and that saves a huge number of lives in the campaigns in North Africa. Then in another case, they lived on a restricted 3-month diet, and then they ate of meat, cheese, and jam, far below what they need for health, but then they allowed themselves unlimited quantities of potatoes and bread. And then they went through the English countryside with rucksacks full of bricks, and they engaged in extreme physical exercise. You see what they're trying to do? They're trying to push the limits of, you know, the limits of what a healthy diet is. Okay. All right. So that's kind of, that's our little story about nutrition science history for today. All right, can we turn to proteins?
All right, let's go through our, worksheet questions, but also let's kind of go through the chapter as well. So can somebody just tag us into this? What are proteins chemically? We already just said it. What are they?
Amino acids.
There are 20 amino acids. We'll take a few notes on this. You don't need a lot, but just something to kind of remind you of the main things. So there are amino acids, which we finally did discover in the 1930s. And what do we need to know about amino acids? What's the crucial distinction among amino acids?
There's nine that are indispensable that your body can't produce enough of.
That, yeah, and then we'll just add one detail. So that's the crucial detail. You can't make nine of them, but there's also some that are conditionally indispensable in the sense that if you have one of them, you can make the other. But if you don't have one of them, you can't make the other in that list. So again, it's a point about complexity, right? So when you look at nutrition data itself, let's take a look at this. This is a nice little practical lesson. You see this protein quality score. So fish oil has tremendous vitamin D. It has zero protein. If you look at chickpeas, chickpeas have a score of 106. And when you learn about these protein quality scores, they're basically saying anything over 100 means that it has all the essential amino acids. Okay? So in the... All right, so that's the first point. So chickpeas, garbanzo beans, shaychi, are a complete protein. If you look at sesame seeds, which are often advised as a complement to garbanzo beans, they're missing one of these. And notice they have a protein score that's under 100. So when you, just a point about the nutrition data site, when you see a protein score under 100, you know there's a link here to complementary foods. And so let's start some notes on protein complements. So a food that's a complete protein has what? It has all nine amino acids also in the proportions that your body metabolizes them. So that's crucial. You can have all amino acids, but not in the proportions that you need. If a protein's incomplete, then you can match it with another food. So what are some of the traditional protein complements? Anybody? You know these traditional food? Okay. So beans and rice. If you went on the nutrition site and looked up beans and rice, that you might find that they complement each other. And that. You've got an inset here. If you look at page 52.
Steak and potatoes.
Steak and potatoes, yeah. Okay, so this is... most meat sources of protein are complete proteins. And you learn in this chapter, this is something, an example of a topic that I'd encourage maybe somebody to research. You learn in this chapter what I think is the truth, which is that meat generally has a higher quality protein than plant sources of protein. Now, what's confusing to me, the reason I'm suggesting this is a good research topic, is that when you read vegetarian literature, nutritionists even will say, plant proteins are complete, too. And you just saw garbanzo beans has a score over 100. So what is the difference in quality between meat and plant proteins? If some of you have a science background and you're curious about this topic, I'd really like to get some light on it. It's not easy to sort out. So you have the traditional advice about protein complements. You have traditional, what I think is mainstream nutritional knowledge about the quality of meat protein and animal protein sources. So yeah, you can complement this with meats, but you can also complement it with other non-meat foods. So yeah, if anybody's interested in that, I think there's really a discrepancy in food literature about protein quality. I think vegetarians have a kind of a reluctance, in my opinion, to acknowledge that that animal protein has a generally higher quality. On the other hand, some of the data that we report on these nutrition sites suggests that if you looked at lentils, you'd see this too. Lentils have 146 for their score. some of this data suggests that plant-based proteins are great. Okay? So that's a question that I think needs more research. I think that might be worth looking into. Okay. Let's go back to our worksheet. Let's get some of these major, we'll just thumb through this together. We don't need to drill down too much. What are some of the major functions and metabolic processes that protein provides? Let's just get a list going from your answers and we'll add to them. Anybody start?
Yes. Structural tissue building.
Yeah, right. Protein's good for muscle. What else? I think one of the interesting things here is that that's the first answer that most of you would have had before you read the chapter, right? So what else? There's a lot more.
Balances the pH in your blood.
Yeah, it balances pH and also balances water. So there's a whole chapter in this nutrition textbook on water balance. We're not going to get to it. But don't just think in terms of nutrients, right? Remember, that's kind of nutritionism. You should also think about how these nutrients affect metabolic processes that include balancing water chemicals in your body. Nitrogen balance is another one. Add to your list, right? Okay, what else? You can actually tell when you're doing that because you get this ammonia in your urine.
It helps with your metabolism and your digestive system?
Absolutely. It's part of metabolism. It's part of digestion. It's part of it helps your immune system. It helps transport vitamins in through your body. Lipoproteins are necessary to transport fats in water-soluble blood. So sometimes you can have a deficiency of a vitamin, not because you don't have enough of the vitamin, but you don't have enough lipoproteins to carry those vitamins through your body. Kind of interesting. Again, it's just everywhere you turn when you study nutrition, you see complexity. It's just, there's nothing simple.
Yeah, and things like hemoglobin and albumin are really important for oxygen delivery, so if you don't
good.
Have enough of those proteins,
right.
You're going to be deficient in
right.
your
right. Right, so oxygen deficiencies hurt your muscles as well?
Well,
okay.
everywhere.
Good, excellent. Okay, anything else on our list of metabolic processes? Energy levels, people who have protein deficiencies report low energy level. There's a hormonal relationship with cell signaling, whatever that is. I don't really understand that very well. Okay, so we talked a little bit about, there's a lot in this chapter on several of you are exploring vegetarian diets. So I'd really encourage you to pay attention to the chunk of this chapter that talks about protein balancing and protein complements. I think there's some good stuff in there. Okay, and then what did you learn about where we digest protein? This is kind of interesting to think about how protein comes into different how nutrition happens in different parts of the body. I'll just do this for you. Protein digestion occurs both in the stomach and the small intestine. It doesn't occur in the large intestine. In fact, if you get protein into your large intestine, it causes problems. It's called protein putrefaction. Doesn't sound good, does it? Okay. So the mechanics of protein digestion, I don't know that we need to spend too much time on. Let's see. Yeah, this is an interesting one. Let me see what you guys can speculate with this. Did you notice the data on protein consumption for Americans? Anybody see that statistic? This is question 4. Anybody catch up? Yeah.
We went up from 1990, we were eating 101 grams a day, which is 70 calories.
And 70 grams for women, yeah.
Yeah, and then it moved up to 111.
Yeah, so we eat 181% of the dietary reference intake for protein. And women consume 152% of that. So we've talked a little bit about protein before, and so why is that? Yeah.
He was talking about how Americans eat a much larger percentage of animal products
right.
than those in other countries.
Right. So one hypothesis is it's not the protein we crave, it's just that we like meat. Right? You see how that, I mean, that would be a hypothesis. I think it might also be the protein. What does it feel like to have a lot of protein? I've been pounding it, so I can tell.
You feel full.
It makes you feel full. You know, I was reading online about the psychology of protein. This guy says it makes you feel grounded. It doesn't make you feel frail. It makes you feel solid. Is that fair? Yeah.
And I know there's like a new thing with flexible dieting where you just eat a bunch of protein. Like your macros, your protein is really high.
Wow.
And it helps you lose weight. So that's like a new thing.
Oh, interesting.
It's a lot of protein.
Yeah, yeah. Over 35%, I wonder. Oh. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
There are
dangers. Make sure this is in your notes. There are dangers of over protein consumption. I mentioned protein putrefaction because that's such a great sound to it. But yeah, so there are problems with it.
Kidneys.
Yeah, I think it stresses kidneys. Is that right? Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, so I don't know. I think there's an interesting issue here there are some things about protein psychology that might help explain this. It could just be because we have a wealthy culture and we can afford so much meat. Okay, could we just, real quickly, could you just get in groups and do the two calculations with each other, if you don't mind, you're doing your weight a little bit. And then we'll, there's a couple of points to make from that, and then we'll be done, okay? So just do it in 2 or 3 minutes if you can, and I'll do mine up here, and we'll talk about it. Dig it out. If you didn't do it, get to it now. Are we close? Are we getting it? You guys have your numbers? All right, let's go through this together. So I think that, you know, I'll give you another minute if you want. I think there's a neat point to illustrate here, but it's also just useful information. I mean, protein count, I think, makes sense. It makes sense to track, something you can track through your day. So let's just do this together and make sure that we're all understanding how to do this. So by percent of calories, it depends on what your diet is. So most of you would have a diet between, say, 1,500 and 2,500 calories. Then you'd figure out figure that the range, recommended range, is 10% of your calories to 35% of your calories from protein. So 10% of that is 150. You divide by 4 because it's 4 grams per calorie for protein. So your range by this method, for somebody like me, is between 37 and 131 grams. I think it's interesting how different it comes out for the other measurement. So by body weight, I'm tipping the scale at 64 kilograms. And most people like you guys would all just multiply that by 0.8, right? Because that's kind of the standard factor for most people. Older people don't metabolize protein as well, so this is why I'm doing this experiment. You know, I'm concerned that maybe that's coming into play. So for me, the range would be 51 to 76 grams. And when I look at protein through my day, based on an analysis that I've done to my diet, I'm getting about 52. So you can see why I'm a little concerned. I'm at the low end of the range for people younger than me. But now, I'm jacking another 30 grams in right there. So suddenly, I'm up around 80, you know, which is pretty cool. We'll see how that works out over 4 weeks. Maybe I'll be really bulky. So how did this calculation come out for you guys? Is it straightforward? Any questions about it? What do you think about the difference in the two? I mean, if protein were really a precisely known thing in your diet, you would expect these ranges to be closer to each other. That's my point. I think the interesting thing about this is it also shows you how approximate these measures are. Because these are both methods, and they...
I was also surprised with how big the range was, like, between your 37 and 131. Like, that's just a big difference.
When
I it's like 10 to 35%, but there's still...
When I do my diet analysis, I have trouble getting over about... Now, that could be because I'm not eating muscle meat. I'm eating dairy and, you know, milk, cheese, and eggs. But I have trouble getting much higher than 17, 18%. So I'm puzzled about this 35. Who's getting this? Mm-hmm. Are any of you getting 35% of protein in your diet? Mm-hmm. How do you do that? I don't know. Maybe some of you mentioned a high-protein diet. That could be it. No, it would be a special diet. Any other thought? That's good. That's a good observation. Thanks. Any other observations about this? Yeah. It might be interesting. Several of you did this in your diet review. You counted your protein.
I think just like when I was doing this, I was thinking like it's so hard to think of how many grams. Like when you're eating a meal, especially if you're like in a rush or something,
good
you're
point.
Not like, how many grams of, you know, protein am I getting this meal? So like, I don't know. Like the percentages I think are nicer, but...
Right.
Kind of hard to like realistically look at your food.
Good. You know, this came up actually in a bunch of diet journals, and I, you know, this may be too extreme for some of you, but I think bought a scale at some point, because if you're going home and you're eating five slices of cheese and you put them on the scale and you see it's 50 grams versus, you know, it's just a very big difference. So measuring in grams, it sounds kind of tedious, but once you know that that's your portion, kind of you know it. And with cheese, the protein's going to be directly related to the weight. Yeah, good. Other? I don't know if that's worth it for you. There's other tricks, like if some of you were worried about your salt consumption. Most of you, the three or four people, this is all I remember, and some of you discovered it was in your processed foods, because that's where a lot of salt is hidden, salt that affects you even if you don't taste it. You can also do this really cool technique where you just, if you want to know how much salt you're getting from your salt shaker, go through a day where every time you shake salt on your food, get an empty plate and shake the same amount. You know what I mean? Like if you do this many shakes, do this many on the plate, and collect that salt. Now the problem is finding a scale that's going to measure milligrams, because, you know, I can't do that. But when you look at it, when you could put it in a teaspoon. What I did was put it in a teaspoon and say, okay, this is a teaspoon of salt. Then go online and look up what the sodium in a teaspoon of salt is. I didn't get a whole teaspoon. Okay? So yeah, measurement, nutrition is real, so something in here is a target, a reasonable target, but the variations are really huge. Okay, let's stop there, guys. Thanks for your attention.